This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Rhetoric around health care and the Affordable Care Act continue to fuel the midterm elections in North Carolina. Incumbent Senator Kay Hagan and challenger Tom Tillis have exchanged barbs over the issue. But what's the impact so far? Today is another in our series of State of Things issues tables. We're talking about health care and the Affordable Care Act. We'd love to hear from you. Hashtag SOT issues on Twitter. Email SOT@WNC.org. Jason DeBruin joins us. He is a reporter with the Triangle Business Journal. Welcome back, Jason.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Give us the bullet points now. We've had about a year to think about this. It's no longer a debate about whether, but what. And the what is ACA is here. What has happened so far? How do we know that ACA has at all changed the landscape in the medical industry, and how?
Well, I appreciate the question, and I think that you can actually say that this really started even as much as 3 or even 4 years ago, sort of when we first started talking about it a whole lot. And more than anything, more than any of the individual policies, more than people buying insurance through the exchanges or the Medicare penalties or any of those things, I think the most important thing that the ACA will have done for us as a nation is that it will just sort of have jarred us into realizing how much that we pay for our healthcare costs. For years, and this really started whenever people started buying insurance through their employer, we sort of detached our payment from our reception of the healthcare, if you will. So we paid out of our paychecks on a weekly or monthly basis. And then if we needed healthcare, we just sort of went and got it. And we never really connected how much it actually costs. So as I always like to say, you know, whenever you compare buying cereals, you stand there and you decide, well, I really want this cereal, but it costs too much, so I'm going to actually go with this cereal over here. Well, in healthcare, we never made that decision because we really had completely disconnected how much that it actually costs. And I think the most important thing that is going to sort of face our nation is that at least we're starting to recognize that, hey, this stuff is pretty expensive.
Well, and the crazy thing about it is that we called it a market-based system because it is private insurance companies. But yet, as you point out, the competition mechanisms are completely disabled. I'm the patient. You're the doctor. We never negotiate. There's a large company that's negotiating with insurance companies in our behalf. And then we go out and pick a provider. And so all of the mechanisms of the market really were disabled in our particular form of
That's true. Brand. That's true. And not only negotiating on our behalf, but negotiating in the dark. We don't even really know how much private insurance companies have contracted with hospital systems to pay for a certain procedure, you know, say like a knee procedure. We don't know if Aetna or Blue Cross or, you know, pick your favorite insurer. We don't really know who's paying more for that because all that is considered a trade secret. So, yeah, I mean, the whole market-based competition, at least the consumer-facing part, was non-existent.
All right. Consciousness raising, A, but does it really affect prices or does it affect how the medical industry works and how medicine is delivered?
Oh, absolutely. I think that there have been a lot of the policies that have definitely changed, A, how insurance companies act, but B, how healthcare systems act as well. You're seeing that certainly in some of the consolidation that's been happening lately where large healthcare systems that had been, you know, largely collections of hospitals are now taking on smaller practice groups and they're being folded into their networks. Certainly that's happening here in the Triangle, both or all three really, UNC, Duke, and Wake Med. They're all trying to get as many of these practices under their wings as possible. You're also seeing a proliferation of these outpatient surgery centers where hospitals are trying to do more procedures at an outpatient setting as opposed to bringing people into their hospitals. So, yeah, I really think that there are a lot of things that have changed how healthcare is provided.
Well, to that, yesterday, Franklin Medical Center in Lewisburg made a move to shift outpatient and emergency services and will no longer provide inpatient care. Tell us about that and how ACA may have influenced that.
Yeah, I don't know that you could necessarily draw a direct line between any one or two ACA policies to Franklin Medical Center closing down, but as healthcare reform sort of takes hold, we really are seeing fewer patients stay overnight at hospitals. And I know you never want to think of patients as customers, but when you're a hospital, I mean, those are your customers. That's how you make money. So when you have fewer patients that are staying overnight in your hospital, I'm sorry, those are fewer customers. You're going to make less money. So Franklin, which is part of the Novant Health System, which is based in Winston-Salem, they made the decision yesterday to drastically reduce the number of inpatient beds that they have. They had 85. They went down to 15. of those 15, 13 are dedicated to geriatric patients. So they're essentially saying we're only keeping two inpatient beds for just sort of the standard private pay patient. But yeah, I mean, this is another example of how healthcare systems are really shifting away from the inpatient model and towards more of an outpatient model. Of course, they'll still have the emergency services there, mm-hmm. and of course, they won't ignore any of the outpatient services. But that's kind of exactly the point, is that they hope to see more patients that stay for a couple of hours, have a procedure, but then go back home and don't stay the night.
All right. So the two big goals of ACA, lower costs, improve outcomes, right? How does any of what you describe broadly meet any of those goals, or does it?
That has yet to be played out in full, of course, but the theory stands that if you are in a hospital for fewer hours, that's a reduction in overall healthcare costs. So if you can have a procedure done at the outpatient setting where maybe your doctor comes in at 8 o'clock in the morning and leaves at 5, and you're in there for a handful of hours, maybe 4 or 5 hours, all your pre-op, your operation, your post-op work is kind of done as concisely as possible. Ideally, that will serve as an overall cost savings. I know it's easy to cherry pick and point at the ACA and this Franklin Medical Center sort of shutting – they're not shutting down, but really paring their services back as a negative effect of the ACA. I see it more as this is part of the transition that the ACA has intended to influence.
Well, so and to that end, what about federal readmission penalties? Does that play a part in any of this?
Absolutely it does. Yeah, these federal readmission penalties, just to give a quick background, is if a patient is discharged from a hospital and then within 30 days is readmitted actually to any hospital, then the first hospital is penalized through Medicare for that patient being readmitted. And the idea being that the ACA wants hospitals to pay more attention to what happens to the patient after they leave. Sort of the model previous to this was, I'm sure you've heard this term called the fee for service, which is essentially where patients come in, they receive a service, they charge a fee. And it was sort of just almost churning through patients at the hospital level. Now, because of these new regulations, hospitals will be penalized if they just simply take a patient in, provide a service, charge a fee, and then if you come back tomorrow, well, we'll just provide you another service. Now hospitals are having to be a lot smarter about when our patient is discharged. Do we get that patient plugged into a primary care network? Do we make sure that patient knows to go to an urgent care maybe instead of an emergency care situation? Just being a lot smarter about that post-discharge care, which is really important because that's where a lot of the waste was, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s. Was these patients that were in the term even high flyer or frequent flyer has been used a lot, where you have these, again, quote, frequent flyers that come through the hospital at a high rate, sometimes 2, 3, 4 times a month. And that was really skyrocketing costs. I heard you talk in the earlier segment about the emergency room in the hospitals being the most expensive form of care. Well, it's true. And so if there's a way to see somebody at the hospital, have a procedure done, make you better and well enough to leave the hospital, make that hospital responsible for then also providing adequate follow-up care, making sure you're plugged into a primary care network, and actually then continue on into getting fully recovered.
Right, because one man's cost is another man's paycheck. So where you put the incentives means everything about the outcomes. And if you make outcomes part of the payment plan, then you're less likely to say, well, they qualify for this procedure. Don't know if it's going to cure them, but what the heck, let's try it. And if you come back tomorrow, we'll give you the next test. There's now an incentive to make sure that or at least have a better idea that this is going to provide a good outcome rather than a return visit. So it's interesting to see and that some of those changes are taking place. But there are other changes across the landscape. And to talk about some of them is joining us now Dr. Tara Lewis, a medical director at Alliance Medical Ministries. Alliance Medical Ministries has been operating for 11 years in Wake County, and it serves around 6,000 patients who have no form of insurance. Dr. Tara Lewis, welcome to the State Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us how healthcare reform has had an impact on what it is you do. Maybe you should tell us a little bit more about who you see and what you do, and then and how ACA and healthcare reform has had an impact, if it has.
Well, thank you very much. We are a faith-led nonprofit medical practice, as you said, founded about 11 years ago to fill what was the gap at that time, the working and uninsured people who go out every day, work 1, 2, sometimes 3 jobs to make ends meet. but for whatever reason cannot afford health care and don't qualify for Medicaid, Medicare. Over the 11 years, you know, we've taken care, very good care of our patients, and we've provided a stable medical home. And the goal being to keep them out of the emergency rooms, out of urgent cares. Medicine really at its base is about relationship. When you build a relationship and you have the trust between the provider and the patient is more likely to come to you first, more likely to follow your therapies, more likely to buy into the treatment plan, follow through on the treatment plan, and achieve a healthy, balanced state. That is the ideal. That being said, when you don't have access to that, you are going to do what you need to do to survive. And we are a nation, I think, that sometimes would rather just survive rather than excel. There are so many things that hit us from day to day. And we understand at Alliance that I can talk to a patient in that 15 to 20 minutes. But once they hit that front door and they're back out in the world, life happens. And so... Yes.
Well, I'm saying it's a great model, and it's certainly it's a great care model. Before ACA, we had way too many human beings in the United States of America with no medical insurance. ACA was supposed to fix that. Now there will be no one without insurance, and yet that's not the case. So what has happened to your caseload? How have things changed for you in the years since ACA?
Well, we've seen a few patients who have transitioned out with the Affordable Care Act who've been able to obtain the insurance through via the exchanges. But we are seeing patients who do not qualify for the exchanges. And because this state did not expand Medicaid, they don't qualify for Medicaid. So they are in that gap. And we are still here to fill that gap. Additionally, what we've seen is changes because of the perception that everyone now, quote unquote, has health insurance, changes in access to ancillary services like medications, the discount list that everyone's familiar with. Those are changing rapidly, again, because of the perception that, well, if everyone has insurance, quote unquote, there's no need for a discount medication list.
So does that mean, and maybe explain that for us, because I think pharmaceutical companies have been providing some form
of low cost
for just these kind of patients. Now you're saying, you know, because, well, we think there's no more need, that's beginning to dry up?
That is beginning to change, and prayerfully it will not dry up or go away. But these pharmaceutical companies traditionally have had wonderful programs called patient assistance and medication assistance programs where patients can apply for free medication, branded medications usually that they could not afford without insurance. And now that there's the perception that everyone has insurance, the formularies are changing, the rules are changing as to who qualifies. And unfortunately, you know, these are national companies that cannot look and make rules on a state-by-state basis.
And in particular, then, you mentioned Medicaid expansion. So they're making rules kind of on a nationwide basis, and then you find a state like North Carolina that didn't expand Medicaid. You have more people uncovered. I guess the impact would be greater here.
It's a huge impact because if patients cannot get the medication that they need, they can't take care of themselves. I can prescribe all day long, but if they cannot afford the medication, they are going to end up with their disease state not controlled and back in the emergency rooms and or urgent cares.
And I understand that you are also working with organizations to help patients sign up because we're moving into round two now for signing up. And are you working with other organizations to help patients get the insurance that they might qualify for?
We provide the information that is provided to us by Enroll America and Get Covered America, and we have signs and flyers throughout the practice, and we encourage patients to really go to the website, consider what their options are, and to help them understand their accountability in all of this. And we've been very successful, I think, in helping patients at least get access to that information. And what I love about it is being able to then transition a patient that does get the insurance to a medical home. And what we are sending to other practices, private pay facilities, are healthier patients, stable patients, patients who are invested in their health care and understand their responsibilities.
Are you also, you've had some time now to think about this from where you stand, you know, do you have changes? What changes would you recommend to ACA if you had a top two improvements you could make?
I think what is available out there is helpful. Some patients are getting access to policies while they may have a low initial premium. The deductibles are high. And so some of the coverage that people are getting may be considered catastrophic. Patients are able to pay, say, $30 a month for a policy. But if they have a $4,000 or $5,000 deductible, it's almost like not having insurance. And that makes some people shy away from getting it, despite the penalty that they would have to pay.
We're talking about health care and politics today on The State of Things. We're talking with a number of folks today to get a sense of how ACA is playing out. And joining us by phone now is Fayetteville Observer's health and poverty reporter, Paige Rentz. Open enrollment for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act begins in about a month, and Paige has been writing about round two of open enrollment. Paige Rentz, welcome to The State of Things.
Thanks, Frank.
What do we need to know about this second round?
Well, one of the things that some of the folks here in Cumberland County are kind of focusing on is that there are two groups of people that they have to hit now. Last year, they were successful with a group of enrollees, and but now they have to touch base with all of those folks to make sure that they understand that they have the right plans for them that fit their needs, and then they also have to make sure that their renewal procedure goes properly. And in addition to that, then they have to, target all of the other people that they didn't reach for whatever reason last year.
That's interesting to think about people who did sign up but may not have the right plan, right?
Right. I'm hearing from folks, that patients that they've seen or places like the Care Clinic, which is a nonprofit here that treats uninsured patients, that people who signed up for insurance may have thought that, they'd go to the doctor and everything would be free, that they would not have any out-of-pocket costs. They didn't understand things like deductibles and those sorts of things. And so they got insurance that they may not necessarily be able to afford.
So as you talked about, Cindy, there's a bigger list. We have to talk to the people who did sign up, make sure they're right, and try to find the people who didn't. What are some of the other challenges the second time around?
Well, it's shorter, for one thing. Last year it was approximately 6 months, and this year you're looking at November 15th, so February 15th. That's about a three-month window. So it's, more people, or more groups of people in half the time. Hopefully, though, this time everyone's hoping the website will work and everything will be a little smoother starting off.
When you talk about healthcare, of course, people really want to talk one-on-one and talk with a human being on the other end. Is there going to be enough support for that?
Well, a lot of the organizations around here are working really hard to get new volunteers. There's a group here called Cumberland HealthNet. They're working through Legal Aid, which got the big Navigator grant. And they are offering to train people as application counselors or navigators and really kind of try to get those people out in the community working to make sure that they're in those organizations that are helping with enrollment. They tell me that, one of the things that they found out is when they did these big info sessions that it wasn't necessarily as effective because people didn't want to ask questions in front of a whole big group of people. So the one-on-one is really important. There's also an interesting program that's happening here at Fayetteville State University, the healthcare management program. There's a teacher there who is training all of her healthcare management students as application counselors. So by the time between the summer class that they had and the time that fall enrollment, the fall classes are finished, they will have trained about 100 application counselors as a requirement for their class. And it's a service learning initiative, so they have to actually to complete the requirements of the class, have to volunteer at least 4 hours with one of the local organizations to help people get enrolled.
And Paige, you got about 30 seconds left, but what are some of the top things you need to consider when signing up this time, first time or second time?
Well, one of the things that people suggest that when you come in and you need to get enrolled, that you need to look at your household income, you need to bring, you need to know birth dates of all the family members of the household, Social Security numbers, all that information. But the biggest thing that you need to bring with you and to consider is the medications you take, the doctors that you want to continue to see so that people who are helping you sign up for a plan can get one that meets your needs. That those are important things to know and to have in mind with you when you come.
All right, Paige, thank you very much. Paige Rentz, a health and poverty reporter for the Fayetteville Observer. Thanks, Paige.
Thanks so much.
Also, thank you, Jason DeBruin, health and business reporter for the Triangle Business Journal, and Dr. Tara Lewis, medical director at Alliance Medical Ministry. Thank you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up on The State of Things, Dr. Howard Fuller, an advocate for education, talks about his life and career. Stay tuned.